Mr. Atkins,
real fine.
After your brother had died, what kind of impact did this have on your mother and yourself and your sister?
I was very surprised because he was the youngest, and I was watching my mother and she wasn't crying, and I found it kind of strange, and but that was the reaction. By then we were so numbed by the all the sort of disasters and what was going round that people didn't react in the way they used to before the war to such tragedies. You were just stunned by it. You couldn't cry anymore.
Was it the first time you'd experienced the death of someone?
The death of someone, yes. My youngest brother, yes.
How did people behave towards people who had TB or typhoid and the fact that they were contagious?
Well, there were many people who had TB. You could see blood as you walked along the pavements, you know, because the blood was in the saliva and in the... And that was... Well, you could see it in the snow. You could see it... people spitting.
Did people go into the hospitals?
There was a hospital, and some people did go to the hospital, but... it didn't sort of, I cannot prove it statistically one way or another. I don't think the hospital was of much use, of the doctors. I don't think the doctors had the medicine. TB was considered incurable in those days in any case. You needed good food and fresh air. That was the cure for TB. And typhoid, I don't remember, maybe with my cousin, younger cousin, yes, they did take her to hospital and she died in hospital, the girl, my younger cousin. But my younger brother died not in the hospital.
You mentioned people were dying from starvation also. Had this become now a real problem?
Yes.
How were people managing to get what food they could get?
Well, everybody got a little bit of food once a week or once a fortnight, I don't remember. Certain provisions you got once a week and others once a fortnight. But if you didn't have any extra, you would be very, very hungry. Also, there was a danger. If you got a loaf of bread or half a loaf of bread for a week, for example, if you didn't divide it into seven portions and forced yourself to eat just that amount every day, if you somehow couldn't resist the temptation and you ate it a bit earlier, by then you got the next allocation. You were so starving that you would eat the whole piece of bread at once, and then of course in no time you were dead.
How was food given out? Did you have rations?
Yes. Yes, you had ration books. And you queued up every week or every fortnight for your provisions, and they varied. It was very, very little. It was something that you could have eaten in one day, had to last you a week or a fortnight. If you were working, you would get a portion of soup during the day. And those that worked had that much extra. And those that did not were really starving.
How was the soup given out?
Well, there were sort of communal kitchens in the workshops or wherever people worked. But then there was a black market, and that's why my uncle, who helped us at that time, you knew that sooner or later whatever was sold on the black market found its way to the German pockets. And through that, a certain amount of food could be bought. For example, for a watch, you would get a loaf of bread or two loaves of bread at that time, or, you know, so many kilograms of potatoes or whatever. So if you had jewelry, watches, silver, fur coats and things like that, there was a black market. There existed a black market. And the Germans were aware of it, and they knew that those various items would find their way into their pockets through various middlemen.
In terms of what was available in the shops via the ration books, what kind of food was available?
Well, there was a little bread, some potatoes, a bit of ersatz coffee, which was not coffee. Sometimes you got a bit of cheese, a bit of marmalade, horse meat, or horse sausages. There were various tins. there were sort of ersatz eggs, which was of powdered eggs, but they were not real eggs.
And you grew your own vegetables?
And all kinds of vegetables. It was...
What about fruit? Was fruit available?
No, there was no fruit. There are a few apple trees growing in the ghetto, but I don't remember seeing an apple for a few, 3 years.
What about household items like cleaning materials or soap?
There was soap. There was a piece of soap with the letter, well, that is a joke which later spread through the ghetto, RIF. It's on a green piece of soap. And the joke was, Richtige Yiddische Fats, that is real Jewish fat. The joke was that the Jews who are being evacuated are being turned into soap. And those jokes started in end of 1941-42. So there was already a rumor that people were being exterminated, but this was a joke saying that the soap that was given every month or so comes from the human
so did
fat.
People in the ghetto already suspected that there were extermination camps?
Yes. I'm going a bit further ahead. When I started working at the post office, I heard probably more than anybody else, being at a sort of a nerve center where the various rumors were
communication.
I probably knew more than many others.
Should we leave that a bit later?
We can leave that, but what I want to say, that although my mother survived the typhoid, she became weaker and weaker, as if she lost her will to live. And she couldn't go to the school anymore, and she couldn't eat anymore. I mean, I was starving, and yet she lost her appetite. And in February 1941, she was bedridden, and we called the doctor, who was a friend of the family before the war, and he wanted my mother to go to the hospital, which was very near where we lived. And she said, no, I don't want to go to hospital. I would rather die in here.
She knew she was going to die?
She knew. And...
Had you already changed accommodation then?
Yes.
No longer at your uncle's?
No longer at my uncle's. But my uncle and my aunt would come every day in the afternoon and would bring some food. And he would even bring an egg now and then, which was unbelievable, but he managed to...
A real egg,
which was unbelievable. And yet she lost her appetite, nothing. And I was starving in those days. And I would feed my mother, you know, some soup or something, but she had no appetite at all. And... On the 10th of March, 1941, she died in my arms, virtually. I was sort of feeding her, and she said, oh, my sister is coming. She heard the footsteps. And by the time my aunt came into the room, which was just walking along the corridor, she was dead.
What had she died from? Is there any diagnosis?
The doctor came and she says brain hemorrhage. That was the doctor's diagnosis. But she was conscious until the last minute. She said, oh, I look better, my sister looks sort of healthier, better. And we thought, oh, she's feeling better, she's eating. And for that, on that day, she seemed, also a few days earlier, she says, oh, I will die when it will get a little warmer. She was talking about her childhood and about her brother who died before the war, whom I didn't know, and her older brother. And talking about the childhood and things like that. And then she died. And my uncle arranged made the funeral arrangements. And that was on a Saturday when she died. And the funeral took place the following day.
Did you have to pay for funerals?
Yes, my uncle made the arrangements. Well, there were all kinds of what happened. He managed to arrange so that the horse-driven cart came and we walked behind it. And also the men at the cemetery, if you couldn't pay or didn't give them some bread, they wouldn't dig. They would say that we haven't got the strength to dig a deep enough grave and so on.
How was your younger sister? How old was she at this time?
I was 16, she was 14, 13 and a half, 14. I don't remember the exact date of her birth, but she was about 2 years younger than I was. And I wrote to my father, because that my mother died, and he wrote letters to his friends who had high positions in the ghetto. And one was Gershovsky, the other one was Podlaski. And I was called by them. And because of my father's letter, my sister was taken into an orphanage, and I got a job. First of all, as a messenger in Podlaski's tailor resort. It was called resort. It was a big workshop, few hundred, of, if not few thousand people worked there, tailoring. And I didn't want to learn tailoring, but I was just a messenger sent with various messages.
Where did you live?
I moved to my uncle's place.
How did your sister react at going into an orphanage? Could she not have lived with your uncle and aunt?
She could, but there was better food. She didn't mind. It was quite good. Also, she had a bit of TB by then. And the orphanage, because of Rumkowski, who was interested before the war, the food in the orphanages was better than anywhere else. And she went to Marysin, which was the sort of slightly more open countryside, actually on the way to the cemetery. And there were young people with slight TB in those orphanages. And she didn't mind that.
Did you visit her there?
Yes. Yes.
How long did you remain as a messenger?
Well, in Podlaski's place, not very long. Then Gershovsky, who had a higher position, you know, was a friend of Rumkowski, he sent me to another place, which I was again a messenger of a woman who was in charge of a workshop making scarves and gloves for the Germans. All women were making beautiful gloves and beautiful knitted scarves. And I was her sort of personal messenger for a few months. Then I went to Gershovsky again. My father wrote one or two more letters. And he sent me to Rumkowski's secretary. And she said, well, what sort of job would you like? And I wasn't very clever. I should have said working in a communal kitchen or a bakery. But instead I said I would like to work at the post office. So postmen had caps and sort of special vans, and we could walk at night and all kinds of things. So I got a job at the post office as a messenger, as a postman messenger. There wasn't a great difference, but any kind of uniform in the ghetto was useful, was important, and I got the job at the post office. And my cousin, who was a bit older than I, the son of my uncle who was helping us, he got a clerical job at the post office. By then, this was the end of 1941, by then more and more people who were not working were being sent out from the ghetto.
How did this happen? What do you mean, sent out? How would this...
Well, people who didn't work, especially with large families, got notices. Their food was cut off, so they wouldn't get any food, and they had to report at the railway station in the ghetto to be sent out from the ghetto.
So the trains were running out of the ghetto?
Yes, but there were cattle tracks with... They were put into wagons, cattle tracks, and well, later we learned that they were being killed with... they were put into vans in near Helmno.
Where did they think they were going at the time?
They didn't know. Nobody knew exactly, but nobody wanted to be sent out from the ghetto. You see, I was then, as a messenger at the post office, we were the young men who were bringing those notices to the various people. And we were nicknamed the Mauhamuves, which is the angel of death is here with the notice.
Did that worry you?
Hmm?
Did that worry you? Did that bother you?
It wasn't pleasant, because you brought to somebody a piece of paper saying that they must report next week to such and such, to the railway station. And the people would sort of burst into tears.
How would you respond?
Wasn't very pleasant, but...
Was it difficult by this time to get a job? If people wanted jobs so as not to be evacuated from the ghetto? Was there beginning to be a shortage of jobs?
I don't know. I cannot tell. If you were a tailor or a shoemaker, you could get a job.
Was there not a kind of rush to get jobs to protect yourself so as not to be...
Well, Rumkowski, he wanted as many people as possible to work in the various places. There were long hours for very little pay or very little food, but some people just couldn't work physically. Either they were too old or too young or simply incapable of working by then because they were so starved.
Would young children and old people be taken out of the ghetto?
That happened a bit later. No, first of all, they were sending whole families. Rumkowski was making the lists. He had to supply 1,000 a day or 5,000 a week or whatever. The Germans would insist that a certain number of people should be taken to the station every week. And he had to make the list. So he would put in people with large families. First of all, those that didn't work. He put all the sort of so-called criminals, whoever had any... a record on it. He put sort of prostitutes, people who had some sort of bad reputation on the list. He would then he would put all those that didn't work, because he felt that those that are working for the Germans are youthful, and therefore the ghetto will get more food and will survive. Then he started putting on the list people where one person worked, but there was a big family. And eventually my uncle and his wife and his son, although the son was working at the post office, they were put on the list because he ran out of the unemployed.
Did people resent him?
But it was families. He would not send the wife and three children, but leave the husband to work in there. It was always families. And the people who would... First of all, the food would be stopped. They wouldn't get the food from the shop where they got before. But if they reported to the railway station, they would get a loaf of bread and marmalade or something. That was the carrot and the stick.
For the journey.
And those that tried to hide them, to go into hiding, would starve. It was virtually impossible. Although my uncle managed to hide. Because of his sort of black market activities, and because of the number of watches and silver and the jewelry and all this sort of stuff that he managed to conceal, he went into hiding with his wife and his son. I stayed in the room because the police were not after me. This is the winter of 1941-42.
Were these Jewish police?
Yes.
How did people react to them?
They were not so bad because although you were afraid to leave the ghetto, you realized that staying in the ghetto meant starvation for you. Therefore, it's not like that you knew you're going to be killed if you leave and you're going to survive if you stay. It became a kind of uncertain whether it is better to leave or not. On balance, people were more afraid to leave than to stay. But those that were leaving, majority were in such a state that they would have died within the next 2 months in any case. And those are the people that were leaving.
Did people begin to resent the Judenrat for making up these lists? Did they blame anybody?
Majority of those that were put on the list were already virtually beyond any form of resistance, beyond even being angry. They were already so hungry, they were already so ill. That is the impression. And those that still either had an ability of buying some food on the black market, those managed to stay behind for a little while longer.
Where did your uncle hide?
I don't know where, but he simply went to another room where he wasn't registered. You know, if you had some connections and you paid somebody in some currency that was useful, that sooner or later went to the Germans. It wasn't too difficult at that, probably.
Was this the time then that the rumours began about what was happening to people who were evacuated?
The rumours began, end of 41, beginning of 42. Already there were rumours that they are killing.
Did you have any idea how this was happening? What kind of killing, in what kind of place?
No, I remember one of the men at the post office saying that the Germans have got lorries that can go up mechanically and the corpses are being thrown into the ditches, which in those days seemed very fantastic inventions. You see, I remember one of the men at the post office. Then in those days also, was it then or a little later, the gypsy camp was formed at the edge of the ghetto. They formed a gypsy camp.
Who formed the camp? The Germans?
Well, the Germans.
How large would that have been? I mean, approximately how many gypsies?
I think about 5,000 gypsies were brought into the camp.
What were they living in? Was that housing?
It was the winter. I think it was 42. 42. Winter 42. It was very, very cold. They broke all the windows. They took a block of few tenement houses. They broke all the windows. One of the postmen, this was on his route on the way towards the cemetery. And the gypsies were put into those tenements. The windows were broken so that they would freeze to death. And they were not given any food. And then the Kripo, which is the criminal polizei, which was, well, there was another branch of the German police. They went there and they were stabbing them and killing them. And they made some of the gypsies play their violins. The postman on whose route it was came with sort of terrible stories for a couple of weeks when these killings took place. And then the Jewish drivers with the horse-driven carts had to take the corpses to the cemetery, and they were buried in some mass graves.
All of them? They all died?
Yeah.
What was the makeup of this group? Men, women, children?
Men, women and children.
So it was family groups?
Gypsies, yes.
How were they all killed? I mean, they weren't...
They were starved to death, they were frozen, and then they were stabbed.
So, during the few weeks, this criminal police would kill some, but then was there a mass killing at the end?
There were, I don't know, a few hundred corpses every day.
And they were just all buried in the same...
They were thrown out of the windows. There was a case. Where the Germans on guard, because they were not, they were standing on guard between the ghetto, on the gate between the ghetto and the gypsy camp, and the Germans standing in the snow had straw boots on top of their other boots to keep the cold, and one of the Germans threw a baby wrapped in a blanket, and the guardsman was kicking it like football until it hung on the barbed wire.
Was there any attempt on behalf of the Jews or the gypsies to communicate with each other?
No. We were not allowed to walk on the same side of the road. It was dangerous to walk too near, and you wouldn't, apart from the postman in his cap, who would sort of go to the other buildings further down. He was the one that was coming by and telling me the stories. One of my friends, who is here in London now, he was taking the corpses from there and taking them to the cemetery. So I knew what was going on, but it was, no one would go and watch it because he would be shot.
How did the Jews feel about the gypsies?
Well, you were completely helpless. There was absolutely nothing you could do about it. It was frightening. You were kind of... At the back of your mind was the fear that is somehow what is going to happen to you. But you tried to sort of close your mind to it and not to see the horror of it.